Welcome to the Whiskey Congress. Honest, open talk dedicated to speaking the truth to those who are open to hearing it. Black, white, right, left. Most importantly, honest, bold, and fueled by good whiskey. In Whiskey Veritas, we are Whiskey Congress. Join the evolution.
Whiskey Congress is in session once again. We've got our guest again, so a little bit different this time because Steve and I are not in the same place. Steve is hunkered down at home, respecting the quarantine. Ben at Existential, E-X-I-S-T-I-A-L, I'm sorry, E-X-I-S-1-0-I-A-L, who has joined us before to talk about the markets, is also with us. Ben, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
Steve?
I'm doing good, how are you?
Good. So Ben, whenever you're here, we talk markets. The markets have been wild for the past several weeks. If you want to just jump in and say what your thoughts of, so let's just throw the date in. It is what, Tuesday the 14th of April, almost exactly 1 month into the state of Ohio being on lockdown. Not exactly. I mean, we can go out and do whatever, but it's, you know what I mean. I love to throw drinks too, because I'm drinking some whiskey. I'm drinking my, my Cleveland whiskey.
Nice.
Nice. Out of a Glencairn. Ben, what are you drinking?
I'm actually drinking, I got my little 375 of Whistle Pig here. Ooh. I'm drinking 10 years old Whistle Pig tonight. I got a little orange slice in there and, nice King Cube. So nice. I'm trying to do it right. What about you, Steve?
I'm just drinking soda water out of a giant Steeler thermos.
Are we allowed to boo that? Or
no, you can boo the soda water. If you boo the Steeler, glass, then we will have an issue.
All right. I just don't want to pretend that, you know, that drinking whiskey is, you know, in some way, not in decorum
it absolutely is, especially for the people that share your company this evening. I've been on a pretty good fitness kick lately, so I'm trying to abstain for the duration, so we'll see what happens.
All right, man. I can appreciate willpower, and you know, it's something that I can certainly is commendable, so all good.
When this is over, you can come work out with me.
Hey, listen, man, I one of the things I'm fortunately, I look back and it was a great decision, was putting a gym down in my basement. So thank God, because otherwise I'd be crawling up the walls.
Everything.
It would just be you and your guitar back there, Ben.
Hey, you know what? Yeah, the guitar works out too. It's good to have some things to distract yourself when you're.
Can you actually play the guitar? Do you like sit there and strum it and act like Matthew McConaughey at bongos?
You got to keep in mind, I'm now 40 years old. I learned to play the guitar when I was in college. I've been playing the guitar for a long time, probably 20.
Oh, okay. All right, that's fair. At least you didn't try to start figuring it out when you were 39 and a half.
No. I've been playing a long time. I can shred.
Did you impress a lot of girls with that guitar playing there? Did you, Ben? A little Dave Matthews-esque.
You know what's funny is that Dave Matthews was actually some of the first music I learned, in addition to Neil Young and some classic stuff. But
yeah, we're around the same age, so I was listening to a lot of guys like you learn the same thing at the same time while I was going heavy hardcore hip hop rap right over their bullshit.
Well, and that's where I appreciate artists like Outkast, who actually incorporated guitar into their music. So I actually can play a lot of Outkast. I can play Hey Ya for you if you wanted. That might be.
Maybe cool. We can close out the show with that.
All right. so we can start. We can have a little. What is it like? The Masked Singer or some weird bullshit?
Yeah, right.
One of those weird ads.
We've been talking about updating our intro song, Ben. This could be a collaboration here.
Yeah, all right.
So all right. Anyway, the markets, what are your, if you're going to give an overview of what's gone on the last couple of days, what are your...
I guess, hold on, before we jump into the last couple of days, I think we should kind of maybe do a little bit of a backstop as to, you know, kind of where we were when people were jumping off the cliff with the market kind of going to shit, and then kind of how we got to where we are now. And, you know, for example, you know, Jim, you and I were talking earlier, and Ben, I think you'd appreciate this, is, you know, just looking at my Robinhood account and some of the investments that I've made, I'm 40% up over the last month. Now, that's just the last month, and it's been a crazy month. But if you look at the 3 month, I'm still 5% up as to where I was really before this all started. So, I mean, the markets have been just kind of insane. You know, Ben, obviously you've seen this, not quite this, but you've seen, you know, a dip like this back in 2008. But I guess, so the one question is, you know, how did we bounce back so quickly? And I know you talked about it a little bit last time, but if you maybe want to kind of go back into that and talk about where we are now.
Sure. Well, I think for your listeners, it would be helpful to first go back and listen to our conversation. Because one of the things we talked about at that time was as hard and fast as that dip was, we had discussed the expectation that it would be just as fast and violent to the upside as it was to the downside. And of course, that's now materialized to a large degree. So how we got here is just, I mean, obviously just a confluence of factors. It kind of an unprecedented thing when you just shut down the economy. In fact, the market, in my view, has been very resilient. I mean, I read a lot of analyst notes and bank notes that expected 1,500 on the S&P, 1,800 on the S&P. You know, it turned out that 2,200 for now has been the bottom. And from there, we've seen a pretty substantial retracement. We've seen 50% of the downtrend retraced, which is pretty wild to think about that happening within a matter of 45 days. So how we got here is obviously, I mean, there's a fucking global pandemic. We shut down the fucking economy, shut down the entire world, frankly. I mean, that's what's crazy about. And so I was actually thinking about this, and this is kind of a side thought, and we can circle back to it, but I'll just put it out there now. And let's definitely circle back to it. But when, usually in the market, there's something that happens that's isolated to a country or a sector or some data point, and the market reacts to it, and it dips, and you see the typical dynamics play out. In this case, the entire world is impacted by this. And the Fed has implemented unprecedented, accommodation to this market to keep it supported. I mean, to the tune of really like $8 trillion, if you really want to total it all up. So that's totally unprecedented. So what I would say is, we've never seen a global pandemic to the extent that it's affected the entire world, that the Fed has reacted so quickly with such firepower. It's almost like the market has priced in the fact that everybody's affected. Now that the Fed has increased liquidity, we've kind of maintained, you know, valuations in risk assets. And that's why I think we've seen the market get buoyed up from those 2,200 lows on the S&P.
Ben, let me jump in and ask you a question. So,
sure.
You know, you're talking about the Fed and their, injection of liquidity. And so, you know, there's a lot of debate on whether this is a good idea, a bad idea, and you can't just print money. Where do you come out on what the Fed has done to, like you said, kind of buoy where we're at?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, that's the big debate. I saw a really interesting, and it actually went viral, the debate that one of the, Scott Wapner from CNBC had a debate with a gentleman from a private equity firm that was of the opinion that, you know, we should let airlines, for example, go into default, go into structured bankruptcy, which I understand. I get his point. In fact, I was of that thinking back in 2008 when GM needed emergency liquidity. You know, I was a young guy and I wasn't all that smart back then. I didn't understand. I didn't understand the cascading effect that that might have on a very interconnected global economy that we're in right now, that we were in back then, but we just, you know, I didn't have the depth of understanding that I do today. My feeling is that the Fed has done an exceptional job, because they've not just, you know, kind of greased the wheels in the financial markets with regard to their repo programs. So that provided liquidity to options traders, people like myself. It helped, you know, unlock the markets and create price discovery where, you know, you didn't see spreads. And when I say spreads, I'm talking about the bid and the ask, and that's what locks up markets. If bid and ask get too far apart, you'll get into a situation where you can just run into a free fall because there's no buyer. And that's kind of what the Fed is. They're the buyer of last resort in this circumstance. Now, keep in mind, they're the buyer of last resort, but that doesn't mean that it's a grant or a bailout, as people like to call it. It just means that they're adding these risk assets to their balance sheet in the interim. They will wind those down, but it just helps stabilize the markets. What they've done is they've gone a step further, and now they're providing liquidity to the private sector in terms of buying high yield corporate debt, which is, that's never happened before. That's a new one. And then of course the congressional mandates through the CARES Act is facilitating small business loans, which are in fact forgivable loans. So those are grants. That is a bailout. That's technically a bailout. If you're just getting free money, you don't have to pay it back. That's a bailout. So if anybody wants to talk about a bailout, the bailout that's been congressionally mandated is for the small business owners. And that's where it should be mandated.
Right. And that was my next kind of point. Like, you know, bailing out the small businesses is good. You know, and then where people might get confused is if they think the money is going directly to, you know, your large corporations, your Fortune 500, and like not only are they getting the money, but, you know, there's a misunderstanding of their requirement to pay it back. So quiet over there, Jim. That's not what's happening here, especially with our larger corporations. The idea that they're just getting free money that they don't have to pay back with no strings attached, right?
Right, exactly. And I think that's generally misunderstood. I think when people look at, like, for example, Boeing, who hasn't, by the way, taken a dime yet. In fact, they're actually tapping the private markets to see if they can get, you know, some, you know, get some bonds purchased. In the private market, they may not need federal assistance, but everyone automatically assumes and just calls it a bailout. You know, right now the hot debate is among airlines, and you know, when you think about airlines, I mean, yes, we could allow some of these airlines to go into structured bankruptcy, but you know, how does that benefit the American public?
Eventually it'll end up driving up prices for airlines. And things like that, which hurts the consumer and doesn't really do anybody any good, I'm kind of guessing.
Exactly. I mean, they just need liquidity. They don't need a grant. They need liquidity. They just need to be able to bridge the gap. It's essentially a bridge loan. And I don't think there's anything wrong with the government being the, you know, the lender of last resort in this case. And I think for the airline industry, it's unfortunately, and again, it's one thing for Darwinism to call the herd, so to speak, in right. the sector. And I don't have no issue with that. I mean, I have no problem with structured bankruptcy with companies that are insolvent or have been irresponsible. But the issue is that this is a global pandemic that, you know, obviously these guys had not hedged against to the extent that they could expect that they'd see literally 98 to 100% drawdown in demand for a protracted period of time, you know, 90 to 120 days. We don't even know.
You know, what's funny though is the All England Club, where they host Wimbledon, they can make the argument that you should have seen it coming because they actually hedged against it. I don't know if you saw that, but they, you know,
yeah,
they
got that crazy.
I saw that.
Yeah. I mean, which is, you know, I mean, and I mean, that's a way different scenario altogether. I mean, they have, you know, a 2-week event, you know, once a year that they're insuring against, as opposed to, you know, the millions of dollars that come in for airlines on a daily basis. So it's not anywhere near the same, but it's just interesting how some people took what happened with SARS the first time around and some of these other sort of global pandemics that didn't quite get this sort of attention and said, you know what, we may need to kind of be ready for something like that if it happens again.
Right.
Well, and Ben, if you remember 2008, all the companies, all the banks that were doing their, you know, shell game and shady dealings were all insured against things going bad. The problem is they were all insured with AIG that didn't have nearly the capital to back up what they had insured, right? So this pandemic insurance, let's see how many of them made promises they can't keep.
Yeah, well, there's two issues here, right? So one is the, you know, insurance and the way it's underwritten and the exceptions for specifically for pandemic. I mean, there's obviously business disruption insurance, but pandemic specifically is generally written out of these policies. So it is problematic. And Jim, to your point with regard to 2008, you know, that was a situation where banks were over leveraged and they didn't have the reserves or liquidity to respond to the situation appropriately. So that's another big difference from back then. Banks are very well positioned to handle this kind of, you know, financial event, certainly much better than they had been in 2008. And you guys probably saw me post the charts of the Fed balance sheet in 2008 versus the S&P versus what it looks like today. And it's two things: the speed with which the Fed has reacted. It took the Fed quite a while to react in 2008, and the market lagged behind. It didn't necessarily respond right away. In this instance, the Fed responded immediately and the market V bottom. I mean, we've seen, like I said, a 28% retracement as of today from a 35-point drop. So, you know, I can tell you just my book, I'm already back above my highs. You know, for me, it's like nothing happened at this point. But keep in mind, you know, I was hedged on the way down. And again, if people could, people definitely should go back and listen to the conversation we had back, I think it was in February, where I talked about just proper risk management. And it's just important if you're running a book and you've got long positions that are substantial positions, you really have to look for insurance. I mean, I use the word insurance. I don't mean to make that sound esoteric or maybe it's something that people aren't, they don't, you know, kind of.
You might want to provide more detail on what you mean by that, because.
Yeah, I mean, there's numbers of ways to do it. I mean, for me, I was using put options against my longs, and I was also buying things like US debt, like the TLT, which is, it's basically an ETF that's just, it captures long end US debt. So 20 year plus treasuries. And that proved to be a really effective hedge. So did gold, in fact, which kind of surprised me. I didn't think gold would be as effective as it had been, but you know, that's the way I hedge. But keep in mind, I covered those hedges before St. Patrick's Day. So I was naked with regard to the downside risk for a period of like 2 or 3 weeks. That's not a comfortable position for somebody like me to be in. I normally am able to buy protection. The problem is that the premiums on options were so high, it just didn't make sense for me to do it. So I just had to just trust my gut and just go long and deploy more cash. And that's what I did. I deployed cash all the way into March 23rd. In fact, I was looking at my statement because I was talking to my cousin earlier today. My cousin is in wealth management. So he has a little bit of a different strategy than me on the hedge side. I'm a little more aggressive than he is, but we were talking about it and I was looking at my my statement. And, you know, my heaviest buying days were March 19th and March 20th, which was a Thursday, Friday, and then March 23rd, which ultimately was the bottom. So it worked out well.
Oh, yeah. Your family conversations are different than mine.
Well, then, well, we do it over whiskey, I'll tell you that. So maybe
they're still different.
All right.
You know, there's two things I want to go back to. One, kind of going back to how we're kind of discussing things, you know, with the government coming through with the CARES Act and saying, all right, we're going to grant people a $1,200 check if you come in at AGI under, you know, $99,000 or $75,000 a year, or, you know, $500 if you have a kid. You know, and I don't know if this is a big deal. Some people are calling that a stimulus check, a stimulus package. And I don't think it's necessary. I don't see it as a stimulus. I see it more as, you know, economic relief, you know, to kind of keep things, as you said, buoyed, to keep things kind of going in the right direction. You know, there's the debate on whether it's enough because Canada is doing this and the UK is doing that. You know, do you get caught up in the semantics of stimulus versus economic relief? Does that much matter to you? Or is it just, you know, first of all, get the checks out and then we'll worry about it later?
Yeah, get the checks out. We'll worry about it later. I mean, people need liquidity, just like the banks needed liquidity in 2008, just like the airlines need liquidity right now. Main Street needs liquidity, and you got to get the fucking checks out. You know, that's the fucking problem. The program, it's a shotgun program. The infrastructure wasn't in place. First of all, obviously the PPP thing, which is the small business relief, the infrastructure hasn't been in place. I mean, you heard JP Morgan and Morgan Stanley and fucking Wells Fargo. They all said it last week. They're like, there's no fucking way we can do this shit, because they are on the hook for this shit. These guys have to be risk assessors. This isn't like just fucking free for all. Everybody gets free money. At the end of the day, the banks, their dick is still on the fucking line. As it relates to the stimulus checks, that is a bailout. That's a fucking bailout. And it's an appropriate bailout, because we need to bail out the US taxpayer, because they're being told by the government, hey, you can't fucking work, man. You gotta stay home. And you still gotta pay your shit. So you know what? Yeah, the fucking government needs to cut you a fuck. Uncle Sam needs to wipe your ass right now. And
that's gotta be hard for you to say. I know you're a fiscal conservative and a small government guy. So for you, this has to be a really tough. I mean, I respect your willingness to say, this is the exception to my normal rules, but that has to feel like a jagged pill to swallow.
Yeah, no, Jim, you're 100% right. I mean, this is why we have federal government. It's exactly why we have federal government. And to your point, Jim, in a normal environment where we're not in the midst of a global pandemic, it's the last fucking thing you'd hear from my mouth. But you're absolutely right.
We're there, and to your credit, you're willing to say, this is not my normal stance, but we're in an unforeseen, unique for our lives circumstance, and you got to do things differently than just say, well, we're going to cut taxes on the wealthy and the money will trickle down. Well, right now, that ain't going to happen. And you know, I'm friends with lots of people in the service industry between being a regular bar goer and a stand-up comedian, and you know, those people are really struggling. I mean, you know, they went from not having health insurance, not having paid leave, but making ends meet, to you can't do shit. And some companies are doing a pretty good job locally that I know are doing a good job of supporting their staff. And some of them are saying, sorry, but I'm not bringing money in.
I think the key point to remember in this example is that the government has imposed this on people.
Yes.
If the government's going to impose it on you, they need to take responsibility for the economic impact of that decision. So in this case, it is a little different. And Jim, and I have no problem with saying that. Yes, I'm a fiscal conservative. I'm a conservative ideologically, but I'm a reasonable guy.
I give you tons of credit, though. Some people would double down and say, you know, never government, never this, Second Amendment, blah, 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 as I say this with a gun behind my head.
But you know, that's a great litmus test for who's a complete fucking illiterate dumb fuck who you should even give two thoughts to, you know, considering their opinion, and other people that are actual human beings that maybe have some semblance of understanding of what the hell's
I think you have more than some semblance, but illiterate dumb fuck is always a score point for me. So.
Fair enough.
So Ben, one thing I wanted to go back to, you know, you talked about sort of our kind of global economy getting a little bit exposed. So I guess the question is, without dancing around it, is, you know, should we look at this pandemic and look at how exposed we were? I mean, the entire world basically shut down, and it caused some major disruptions in, you know, supply chain and the markets, as we saw. You know, should countries start to look at, you know, obviously, and maybe I'm going to answer my own question, but, you know, less dependence on China and, you know, maybe unraveling this tangled web we have with other economies. Is that something we should consider, or do we say, you know, let's continue to push forward, but maybe we backstop a little bit better, you know, going forward?
Well, I'll try to give you as short as an answer as possible, because I think Jim can weigh in on this and give some really interesting perspective coming from the pharmaceutical side, because that's obviously one of the most vulnerable areas. But my feeling is that we're addicted to cheap goods. I mean, let's just be honest. And our standard of living as it relates to our costs versus our income is not going to change. So globalization is kind of here to stay, so to speak, in that sense. Now, can we reconfigure supply chains, as you pointed out? Yeah, of course we can. The question is the American consumer willing to pay a premium? And to what extent can it get undercut by someone who does stick to a supply chain that's using Asia or South America or other parts of the world that have, you know, cheap labor and very low unit cost? So I don't think the economics necessarily change. What I do think is going to change, and then Jim, I want you to jump in on the pharmaceutical side. What I do think is going to change is this is a profound psychological shift for people. The paradigm is completely changed. There's a psychological and a behavioral change that's going to happen. We're going to start to see, I remember, I don't know if I shared this with you guys, my cousin lives in Shanghai, China.
Oh.
So he was kind of giving me the heads up on this stuff a long time ago. And unfortunately I could have positioned myself better from an investment standpoint. And I didn't, because I was stubborn. I was dumb. Did I get ahead of it? Sure. I got ahead of it more than most people, but I was a little bit dumb. But when you go to China or you look at what happens just from a behavioral sociological standpoint in Asian countries, I mean, wearing a mask around, like a surgical mask, that's
normal.
Not a big deal. I mean, that's going to become the normal, you know, mode of operations here in the United States. Think about the restaurant business. Jim, you mentioned it earlier, service industry. How are restaurants going to open up and mitigate potential spread? They're going to have to, you know, a 200 cover restaurant is now going to become a 100 cover restaurant, because you're going to have two tops that are 6 feet away from each other. I mean, there's going to be a cascading, all of these unintended consequences that we haven't necessarily thought through and figured out yet that are going to materialize. And, you know, we need to be thinking about that.
It'll be a behavioral shift. It'll be, we're dealing with something now that I'll be honest, I'm someone who, when I would see footage from Seoul, South Korea, or, you know, Beijing, or, you know, another major Asian city, and I would still see people wearing surgical masks, I would think, you're overreacting, come on. Well, right now, I feel like I've been wrong, and they were right. And without getting into the medical side of what the masks do, and to your point about the pharmaceutical industry, in every company I've worked for, they have had, I'm going to finger quote, requirements saying you can't have a product dependent on a single source. So it was never about a global pandemic. It's a situation where if your API stands for active pharmaceutical ingredient, and that's what makes a drug work. There's other things that go into making certain kinds of drugs, and I'll not nerd out on you right now, but
thank you.
Thanks, Steve. But the API, the actual ingredient, is a very specialized chemical manufacturing process. And every company I've ever worked for or with has said you need to have a second source, and they almost never actually do. It's in there. This is what we intend to do, but there's no real incentive for a chemical manufacturing site to be prepared to make a product when you are their second choice.
Right.
And a lot of times the first thing that comes into play is price. And when companies do this, they're not thinking about a global pandemic. They're thinking about, to keep it simple, let's say you have a manufacturing site in Oklahoma, and you want to be prepared for the fact that, well, Oklahoma's in Tornado Alley. If we lose that plant because of a tornado, we can't suddenly stop supplying our patients who need this drug to survive. Fact is, a lot of APIs are made in China. And even though the finished formulation is manufactured in the US under strict FDA guidance, the actual ingredient comes from China. And if they have to shut down their operations, and if, like most companies I've dealt with, you've got a plan to get a second source, and you've got a quality assurance team out there who is seeking a viable partner that will accept the terms of your quality business agreement, if you don't have them and something like this happens, you run the serious risk of just being like, well, we can't make that because the stuff that actually makes you get better isn't available. And you don't put together a chemical plant with regulations in place. Starting up an operation like that takes 12 to 18 months if it's fast tracked. Now, that's because of the regulations and the checks and balances, and those are generally good things. In an emergency, agencies have a way of temporarily suspending some rules and putting in, band-aids, for lack of a better word, to say, under these circumstances, here's what we'll allow you to do. But not getting too political, you've got agencies in China that are protecting their businesses from America, agencies in America that are protecting their businesses and their consumers from, imported drug products. And so this is going to be a really complicated boondoggle to untangle, because we're going to need stuff from China. Again, trying to not Trump bash, but Trump went on TV today and bashed the World Health Organization and China brutally. And at some point, I don't think words on a podium at a press conference are going to cause business deals to completely collapse. But it's a concern if this becomes a battle for resources, and if we don't continue to try to, head in the right direction in terms of infection rate. That's what really scares me. Did I answer your question?
I mean, that was super short and concise. Thanks, Jim. but that's
it was tough guy, because that's the whole detail.
That's, I mean, the reinfection aspect is definitely something like that's got to be a big concern, and it makes me nervous. When Trump puts together his council of getting the economy back up and going, up and running, and there's not a single, health official on the stage.
Right.
And it just makes me wonder. Now, the good thing is that governors have control of this, but I think we know how this is going to go down. The governors that want to pander to Trump are going to do whatever he says and open their states as soon as possible, even before he has anything official out there on Twitter, I guess. And then, fortunately, we live in a state with Mike DeWine where he's going to take the available information with the right people around him and do kind of what's best for the people in the state. Even though there's people, I'm sure in Cleveland and in other places putting pressure on him to get things back going. So it will be interesting to see, how we deal with the idea of reinfection and what states kind of take that into consideration and which ones don't for political reasons.
Well, to your point, Steve, and it's a really good one, which is second wave, potential second wave. So, I'm a risk manager, money manager. I'm not a fucking epidemiologist, right? Or a virologist. And I don't claim to be one, but unfortunately I've had to kind of become an armchair one, right? Over the last couple months, because I've had to handicap the markets. And as I've said before, you can't know about them in stocks until you see a peak in virus. And that's proven to be true. And, one of the issues that I've seen as I've looked at past pandemics, and I actually posted over the weekend about a forgotten pandemic, which was the Asian flu of 1957. And for people that aren't familiar with it, go back, look at my post. And I have some links
That's everyone. There's no one that's familiar with it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, but that's just one example, because it's not only is it the same strain of flu that we're dealing with now, but it's just at, you know, contemporaneously, they didn't even cite it as an economic impact at the time, which is staggering to me, right? Because right now it's like all we're focused on economically. But you go back to 1918, you go back to H1N1, you go back to swine flu, you go back to Ebola, et cetera. Obviously all very different, nuanced in their own right. But every single one of these influenza outbreaks have had a second wave.
Now, this is not an influenza. Coronaviruses are different than influenza, not to nerd on you again. But one good thing about coronavirus is, and I heard this from Dr. Fauci, and I heard it from a friend of mine who's a world-renowned microbiologist, this coronavirus does not mutate very quickly, which is really important, because unlike a flu vaccine, which is, to call it a stab in the dark is unfair, but influenza mutates so fast that a flu vaccine is typically only 30 to 40% effective in a good year because the virus changes. So far, what they're reporting is this coronavirus does not change fast. So if and when they get a vaccine in place, it should be much more effective.
You're going to get the anti-vaxxers all fucking jerked off over that one, man.
They already are.
Jenny McCarthy can kiss my ass literally and figuratively. It's Jenny McCarthy, right?
Yeah, Jenny McCarthy.
She's one of them.
Right, that's the one that...
You know, it's a goddamn shame, man. When I was a young kid, man, she was one of my pinup girls, so that's a good
one. I haven't seen her lately. She still should be.
Yeah, she's beautiful. Let's not get that.
That is a really key thing. One thing I've gone off on our podcast, Ben, is there's people saying once we get a vaccine, everything's fine, and I can't say it enough times. Vaccines aren't a cure. They're a prevention. I am all for preventive medicine, 100% for it. But if we got a vaccine today, it would change the curve dramatically and great. But it doesn't help a person who's already sick. And again, because this coronavirus is not mutating, the effectiveness of the vaccine should be much better than the flu shot. I don't get a flu shot, and I'm a pharma guy, because I know it's less than half effective. And I know that if I get the flu at 48 years of age, more than likely I'm going to have a miserable week, but my mortality is likely not at risk. With the coronavirus...
Your mortality is at risk for other reasons.
Yeah. You're such a funny guy. You know, one of us is a comedian, and you wouldn't guess which one it is tonight.
Well, you know what, Jim? I'll say this.
Sorry to interrupt.
You look pretty goddamn good for 48. I think you're going to be in good shape, my man.
Thank you.
But let's say this. Let's put that aside with regard to, the conversation about infection and so forth. You bring up a really good point, Jim, which is more about duration. And I think that's what's really affecting the markets in terms of, you know, trying to discern what duration looks like. And you talked about vaccination. What we really need to open up the economy and to move things forward, we do need mass deployment of testing, and not just testing with regard to infection. We also need antibody testing, so we know people who have been infected that have since recovered. So until that materializes, and this is where I really struggle with some of these fucking circle jerk clown show fucking pressers that the president's doing. I mean, this is fucking next level shit. I mean, it's unbelievable. What the fuck? I mean, that it's not, you don't have to be a virologist. You don't have to be a fucking epidemiologist. This is really simple shit to figure out. Test everybody. Create a fucking system where people can understand who's been infected, who hasn't. Test for antibodies. Test for, of course, potential spread. It's very simple. Deploy it. Engage the private sector. Incentivize them. And they're more than willing. I mean, you look at some of these Moderna and all these other companies that have been more than willing to participate. That's what we need to do to move things forward.
Because okay, do you think it's really now? What I will say, and this is not necessarily defending Trump, but is that more impacted by you know, FDA and other agencies kind of getting in the way of this, like, kind of needed emergency innovation, because I don't think that's Trump that's holding that up. I think it's just they don't know how to kind of, I don't think the administration as a whole, which is much bigger than Trump, knows how to kind of put this all together. And part of that is on Trump for who he put together in his administration. But I mean, I think that there's a lot of pieces to this that are not, that are part of the problem.
You're keying in on the key problem, which is we have no leadership. There's no fucking leadership. When you have leadership, all of those things fall right into place. Everybody knows exactly what to do. That's what leadership is, man. We don't have it. We got a fucking reality show trust fund guy pretending to be president. This guy has no fucking idea what he's doing. So yeah, I agree with you, Steve, 100%. It should all fall right into place, but it doesn't. Because everybody's, again, this is like the, you know, season 8 of Apprentice, you know, people are, you know, they just don't want to get fired. You know what I'm saying? I mean, it's really, it's a disaster. So in my view, yeah, I think that, you know, this could easily be implemented. You could create a situation where there's a cascading, you know, set of responsibilities across all government agencies. But right now, everybody's fighting against each other. And that comes from the top. I mean, the tone gets set from the top. You know, fishes rot from the head down, right? That's what they say. So that's what we're seeing.
I don't know enough about fish, but sounds good.
Yeah, look, it's just...
Well, let me ask you a slightly off-track question, Ben, but I'm of the understanding that the market was terrified of Bernie Sanders being the Democratic nominee. And it's because Bernie Sanders, whether he would be an effective one or not, is a revolutionary. Now, there's certain revolutions that he was for that I am for, so I'm not trashing Bernie in any way. But the fact that Bernie is out of the picture as
with your fucking shotgun on the wall, you're going
to
tell me
Bernie used to be an NRA sweetheart. and that shotgun's a double barrel shotgun. That's Bernie would approve.
All right. It gives you actually more street cred, so go ahead.
There we go. But do you think some of the market stability comes from the fact that a Bernie presidency is no longer a, for lack of a better word, market fear?
No, that's been priced in for a while now. Okay. After he suspended his campaign, it got priced in. His endorsement of Joe Biden was, you know,
lukewarm.
Yeah, it was kind of, I guess I would say, marginal. I would, though, say, and I had some people that, you know, that disagree with me on this, but I thought Obama's endorsement today of Biden, I thought was actually pretty meaningful.
You just punched Steve in the balls and didn't know it, but thank you.
Yeah. No, look, I think it was meaningful.
I do, too. You know who told me I was an idiot on Sunday?
And let me qualify the comment by saying that if you look at the 2016 election, obviously it was razor thin with regard to popular vote, obviously the electoral vote. You know, Hillary was a horrible candidate. I think we all agree on that.
Absolutely.
Razor thin margin, you know, people did like Obama. I was a staunch Obama critic. Oh my God. I used to fucking rip this guy's dick off daily on fucking Twitter. I ripped him on every, we had a fundamental difference with regard to the role of federal government with regard to Obama. But you know, sure. The thing about Obama was he was articulate. He's an intelligent guy and he never embarrassed me. He never embarrassed me as an American. Trump embarrasses me almost daily. And that's a big difference for me. But I will tell you, his endorsement of Joe Biden in this point in time is very different. Keep in mind, when he endorsed Hillary Clinton, it was later in the race. It was,
sure,
wasn't at this point. And I watched his, you know, his video, and I'm not one of these like Instagram, like Facebook guys that, you know, these people jerk off to this stuff. It's fucking weird. But the Obama video was compelling to me. I thought it was meaningful. And I think it's gonna you got to keep in mind, 30 to 33% of the American populace, the voting populace, is going to vote for Trump no matter what.
Yeah.
About a 15 to 20%, you know, constituency that's independent or moderate, whatever you want to call them, that are, these are persuadable voters. And I think that that Obama statement, I think, is meaningful. And that's just my own personal opinion on it. We can all handicap it. We'll do the autopsy come, you know, December.
Right. But
I mean, and I guess my argument would be is we don't have a third party candidate this time around. You know, we don't have a Jill Stein. We don't have a Gary Johnson. You know, and did they, you know, if you remove those two, then does Hillary get elected, or do those people opt to not vote at all? And so my thing is that chances are, if you get rid of Jill Stein and you get rid of Gary Johnson, then maybe you actually do end up seeing Hillary get elected. Now, I'd have to look at, you know, we'd have to look at the Electoral College, and we have to look at who voted for who in what state, you know, what third party candidates impacted where. Does that change something in Michigan? I don't know. But I guess my thing is, I feel like with only two candidates, I think the biggest issue for Biden are the people who are going to sit out and not vote because Bernie didn't make it. But I think everybody else has kind of made up their mind. I don't feel like, Ben, I don't feel that you're on the fence. I feel that you are going to vote for Biden, and it wouldn't have mattered if Obama like gave his endorsement now, gave it later. If it was, I mean, now listen, Obama is amazing at giving these sort of inspiring sort of speeches, right? Like that's why he got elected. I mean, right. You know, looking at his track record going back to 2008, I mean, like the guy was elected because he wowed people, you know.
2006.
Right. I mean, yeah. At the
2006.
Right. I mean, people, I mean, like he gave that speech, and people were like, well, he's the next president. And they were right. But now I think that you only have two choices. We know who and what Trump is. I think before there were certain people, even I think I hedged Trump a little bit by saying, all right, he's being really ridiculous to get himself elected, but he'll come back to the middle and maybe he'll turn out to be not a complete train wreck. I was wrong. So now we know who he is. I think people like you, Ben, and other people that may have been on the fence in 2016 but went Trump, I think they're off the fence and they're either all in for him or they're happy that it's Biden, it's not Bernie, and they can go ahead and make that jump. So that's a lot to say. I still believe that Obama didn't mean shit, but Obama's endorsement didn't mean shit, but it was very good.
No, look, I think that's a legitimate point. I don't necessarily disagree with you. I'm just putting more weight on that endorsement than you are, and that's fine. But I think it's really important to note, I mean, I'm a staunch conservative ideologically, right? My whole life. I mean, I've always voted Republican in any election that I've participated in. Now,
Ben, I should also point out that the only reason I'm even pushing back on this so hard is just that we recorded on Sunday and I said that it wouldn't mean anything. So now I kind of have to.
And now the lawyer kicks in. The lawyer kicks in is like, I am now getting told I'm wrong by a guy who should be on my side while right. Jim smugly grins at me.
That's right. Listen, if it was the markets, I'd say, you know, I have domain over that. But back to politics, so Steve, you have as much domain as I do. Right. But no, there are a lot of people like me, both. To you, Steve, and Jim, I mean, there's a lot of people like me that are conservative ideologically that have a real problem with Trump. And I think that has essentially gained momentum over the last, not just over the last, you know, 3 years of his presidency, but certainly over the way that this pandemic has been handled, because the evidence is just extraordinarily damning. There is video, there's audio, not only him, but his surrogates, his media surrogates, they have downplayed this from the very beginning, and they look like goddamn fools. Goddamn fools, man. So.
And they're talking revisionist history now, which to me, a leader doesn't play the blame game while the, you know,
exactly right.
House is on fire.
Exactly. You know what the leader, you know what a leader does? They eat shit. The leader says, you know what? I was fucking wrong and I fucked up and I'm sorry and I'm going to make it fucking right. And here's how I'm going to do it. And I'm going to lay it out for you. That's what a leader does. You know what fucking Donald Trump does? He points fucking fingers. He says, you know what? It's the media's fault. It's the fucking Democrats' fault. It's the fucking Chinese fault. Fuck this fucking asshole. I get fucking so upset watching this fucking cocksucker. I get so fucking pissed. I mean, this guy, he's a fucking pretender. How the fuck did this guy get elected? It's a disaster. It's a total fucking disaster. I'm sorry. I don't mean to get.
Other than that, though, he's fine.
You're speaking my language. But I mean, to make light of it, the fact is we're still in the middle of this situation. It's one thing when the ship is wrecked and you reach shore and you want to say, I told you to look at the chart, that's one thing. But when you're heading towards the fucking iceberg or the whatever other nautical analogy I'm gonna sneak in here, when you're heading towards it and you're like, we need all hands on deck. And I watched Andrew Cuomo's press conference today, and he basically said, I'm not going to fight with Donald Trump. I'm not going to get into these games. We need to be together on this. And Trump will say that sort of thing for about 3 minutes and then totally derail. And it's maddening that he doesn't recognize now is a time for not talking about my ratings, not talking about, well, the market's gonna be better than the greatest market I ever created. It's like, how about that?
You just mentioned ratings. How about that? How about that tweet the other day where he's like, these COVID pressers have the best ratings. You guys remember the tweet?
They had Monday Night Football ratings.
Okay. So the whole fucking country's on fucking lockdown. We got fucking almost 20,000 people fucking dead. And every fucking news network is carrying the fucking shit. And you think that the ratings are great because, like, you're a great president? Like, dude, I got no other choice but to watch your shit. I'm on lockdown. What the fuck else am I going to do? It's not like
not true. You've got Tiger King. You have Tiger King.
Fuck Tiger King, man. That's nonsense, too. Fuck Tiger King. Fuck Carol Baskin, by the way.
Oh, and her husband. Crazy.
But seriously, I mean, that blew my mind.
Although at this point, you know, nothing really surprises me, you know, when it comes to just dumb shit that he's going to say. And, you know, I have just come to expect that he's going to say the dumb shit that you would not want a president to say, a CEO to say, your superintendent of your local school, the guy who runs a local cigar shop. You know what I mean? Like, I mean, he's not a good leader. And so as a country, we have to push through and we have to kind of pick through his bullshit. We have to listen to the people around him. You know, a guy like Fauci, you listen to what he says, but you have to be careful with him because if it was up to him, he'd shut everything down for another year and a half. You know, so the balance comes somewhere between the extremes of a scientist like Fauci and the extremes of the ridiculousness of Trump. And I think where you end up is, all right, for right now, I'm gonna lean on my state government. I'm gonna lean on, you know, Mike DeWine and the people that I have right here who I know are doing shit right, you know, and then we'll address all this shit with Trump when it comes to November. And hopefully as a country, we make the right decision. If we gotta deal with them for another 4 years, then for fuck's sake, but at least we know how to deal with them and we know what to expect.
Well, you're touching on a key point. And you've already seen this materialize. There's already alliances on both coasts of governors that are saying, hey, we're going to work together and create these alliances where we're going to help each other out. That they're filling the void of leadership. I mean, that's the beauty of our government, right?
Yeah.
And imagine what that does to Trump's fragile, tiny little snowflake psyche. I mean, no. God damn, his tiny little dick is getting exposed. I mean,
it's coming.
I mean,
there's no problem there, believe me.
But seriously, I mean, honestly, the fact that you have state governors stepping up and creating alliances, I can't imagine what that does to Trump's mentality. You're going to look, this guy he's already lost his shit for sure. I mean, the last press, did you see the last presser when he berated that reporter for asking?
Yes. A question? Yes.
Yeah. So that was
amazing. Did you see today's?
I didn't even watch. I catch the highlights on Twitter, honestly.
He went on a rant where he talked about how I'm going to talk to the CEOs of all these major companies. And then he literally spent, so I was watching CNN, shut up, Steve. I was watching CNN and Wolf Blitzer goes.
I'm fine with CNN. I'm fine with CNN.
Terrible.
They're not that bad. I mean, they're not that bad.
Wolf Blitzer says, let's cut back to the president. He's going to the podium. And he goes to the podium and he starts naming companies and their CEOs and throwing in random praise for Mark Zuckerberg from Facebook and Apple, one of the best companies ever. Good job, Tim Cooks. And he split by like 3 minutes reading off company names and CEOs to the point where CNN said, back to you, Wolf, because I just couldn't take, like, he was reading the roll call. I looked it up. And this is not something I verified, but they said he listed over 100 companies and their CEOs. Just like,
I mean, look, I have no issue.
Hey, still got good ratings, though.
He did get good ratings.
I have absolutely no issue with these news networks breaking away or even covering it, period, because it's all nonsense. I mean, honestly, you watch Cuomo's daily presser, it's so much more informative and direct, and it's just hard data, and it's not some circle jerk. You watch the fucking Trump shit and that's all it is. It's a circle jerk. And I don't understand the significance of that under the.
Being a native New Yorker, granted Western New York, I have a lot of family in New York. Being completely honest, I don't like Andrew Cuomo. And it's mostly because of Second Amendment issues, because he jammed through the New York State Legislature one of the dumbest gun laws ever. My family is largely right-wing, so I have to listen to them say, there's your guy. I'm like, he's not my guy. But I'm not an Andrew Cuomo fan. Having said that, he's coming out of this looking real good. Mike DeWine, who is a very conservative Republican, who I did not vote for, I think he's done an outstanding job. In fact, I initially, when I was in a bar on March 15th, when that he was having his press conference, and everyone in the bar, most of whom work in the service industry, were on pins and needles. And in the back of my mind, I'm thinking, you are overreacting. There is no way Mike DeWine, on a sunny day when everything's looking great, is going to say, you can't go out and drink in Cleveland, Ohio 2 days before St. Patrick's Day. And obviously, I was proven wrong. And obviously, Mike DeWine did the right fucking thing. Steve had me over for dinner the other day with the phenomenal lamb that he smoked. And we were talking at his place about how had normalcy, finger quoted, been left in place, I would have been out on St. Patrick's Day. And the likelihood that I would not have put myself at serious risk is zero. I'm not saying I would have gotten COVID, but I was with a bunch of idiots on St. Patrick's Day drinking close proximity, doing, you know, stupid things. And in retrospect, great job, Mike DeWine. I respect what he's done.
So I'm gonna jump in on the Trump bashing session here. I know we're pushing up against the hour. Sure. So Ben, I know, you know, we're not going to go and give out our favorite stock picks and options and put calls and everything else, but I guess, what are your thoughts on the market, like, moving forward? How should people, you know, maybe what are some sectors that people should be thinking about if they want to get into investing, or if they're just kind of looking at the markets, trying to figure out what to do? I, for the most part, stayed put, and you know, I looked at a couple companies, JD out of, out of Asia, some EFTs and some other things. So where should people kind of be looking, knowing that we can't predict what's coming, but just to kind of, you know, give the people a thought of where they should be looking. Get me out of this. God damn it.
No. I'm no problem, Steve. Happy to throw you a lifeline. My feeling is, having navigated through this, the base case has proven fucking 150% right. And if you guys want to go back and listen to our conversation from back in January or February, whenever that was, tech, cloud, AI, automation, robotics, anything tech has been the leader, and it will continue to be the leader. And that's just a function of Moore's law. I think you're going to continue to see growth in those spaces. I think the other contrarian play is energy right now. I mean, obviously oil has gotten absolutely better. I think energy is a great contrarian play. I do have energy exposure that I've enhanced in this weakness. A lot of it's high yield, so they're going to pay you a dividend. They're going to pay you just to hold the fucking stock in some cases. But you got to find the right balance sheet. You got to find the right companies. I mean, you just can't buy any old oil company. So my feeling is there's a lot of opportunity out there. It's a stock picker's market. And one of the things that a lot of financial advisors, wealth managers are going to tell you generally is, hey, use index funds. That's the way to go. That's not the way to go anymore. It's a stock picker's market now. This is my fucking wonderland. I'm in I don't know if I told you guys this via text. I've sent, shared the messaging with a few other people, but this is ideal environment for somebody in my position doing what I do. It's just totally ideal because this is a stock picker's market. It's a volatile market. It's going to continue to be volatile, I think, for the next couple of quarters. We just got back into earnings season. Banks reported, JP Morgan, Wells Fargo reported today. You're going to see Goldman Sachs report, Bank of America report this week. They weren't necessarily great earnings reports, but I mean, in my view, it's still tech, it's still cloud, it's still automation, it's still AI. And I think energy is the kind of contrarian play right now. That's kind of where I'm at.
Okay.
I hesitate to give specific names because how the sausage is made. I mean, that's literally how I make money.
Right. No, I completely understand. But I mean, it's good for people to have an idea. And I think that if you're getting into investing and you're trying to figure it out, and even if you have someone investing money for you, it's important that you understand, what you're doing. And the only way to do that is to kind of dig in there and start to look at these companies, look at what they do, understand how what they do relates to what's going on in the world, right? Kind of in real time. Otherwise, you're just guessing. You're going off of someone else's analysis, and you don't know why they're telling you that. I mean, you don't know where they're getting money from. You don't know who may have told them to say, hey, push us a little bit because we need the boost or whatever. So you really have to do that research on your own. And when you start to do that and you really start to kind of embrace, the analysis, I guess, then I'm not saying it becomes easy. I can't tell you that I over the last 2 months I've become a whiz, but you do start to notice trends and you start to understand how this stuff works. And instead of a lot of these progressive left, liberal people rallying against Wall Street and the market and saying how people don't have access to it, you don't need a ton of money to get invested. You don't need a ton of money to get involved. You can go on a site like Robinhood or whatever the other one is, the others. There's plenty of others now that are really cheap. They have apps on your phone. Even if you start with $100 or $1,000 or whatever, You can even buy fractional shares and everything else, but you can get yourself involved, and all of a sudden you have a stake in all this shit that's going on. So, you know, Ben, I appreciate your help and your insight. You know, it's always fun to talk about people's dicks getting ripped off with you.
You guys love the dick references. But no, to your point, Steve, you're absolutely right. And it echoes what we had talked about in our last conversation with regard to just, you know, access to markets. Anybody can trade stock and anybody can do it commission free right now. And it's important to just get exposure. It's hard to gauge bottoms. Obviously we can't do that, but yeah, I mean, look, I think we're going to see a lot of sideways chop. I think we've put in the bottom. I think 2200 on the S&P has proven to be the bottom. You know, we used to talk about 2350. I think we might retest 2350. We could easily go lower. I'm not taking that possibility off the table. Again, if you look at past trajectories in similar circumstances, although this is kind of an outlier, yeah, I think it's a reasonable probability that we're going to go lower. In fact, when I was talking to my cousin earlier, you know, my feeling is we will go lower. I don't think we can, you know, this euphoria is not going to continue. I think the market's going to turn on some of the news with regard to some of the cascading defaults that we should expect. Like I said earlier in our conversation tonight, the PPP program, while it's phenomenal, it's a great bailout program for small business, the infrastructure is not in place to execute it. And if you can't get money, you have to, imagine it. Imagine you're a fucking, you know, pizza shop or some shit, right? And you're not doing takeout. And, you know, you've got 5 employees you've already laid off. You need that stimulus check. You need that PPP loan to bridge it. And the bank, you don't have a relationship with a bank, and they can't facilitate this lending facility in a time frame that's meaningful to you. It might take another 3 or 4 months. You don't have enough liquidity on hand to fucking pay your goddamn mortgage, to pay who you're paying rent to. There's going to be a cascade of defaults, and that's unfortunate. So we haven't seen necessarily what I would call, I think we've seen a bottom, but we haven't seen carnage completely flushed out yet. We're going to see a lot of problematic scenarios play out. And Jim mentioned it earlier, even in the service industry. I mean, think about all the service industry employees. In fact, I shared a stat just the other day. 126 people just in the state of Ohio are unemployed for every one confirmed case of COVID. For every one confirmed case of COVID, 126 people are now claiming unemployment. Wow. Crazy stat.
That is a crazy stat. And there's other interesting implications from this, because I'm not trying to spin this as a positive thing, but like smog in LA has been radically reduced because no one's going to work. Harvesting of natural resources. I'm for some reason obsessed with fisheries, and companies that catch lobsters and crabs and other things, a lot of them aren't harvesting nearly as much because there's no one going to restaurants to eat lobster. There's no one going to restaurants to eat swordfish. And so that's going to have a weird impact. I'm not saying good or bad, just it's going to be a weird thing. With some of these cities in China shutting down, they're not pumping pollution into the air. Well, that pollution also gives us products. And a lot of the reasons why those products aren't made here is because we impose regulations that I'm in favor of. But China's willing to turn the other cheek in terms of environmental impact. And when they're shut down, you know, there's effects, good and bad, as a result of that. And none of us know how those will shake out.
Yeah. So we'll see that cascading effect materialize over the next couple of months, several months potentially. Right. And again, that second wave of infection is something we need to be concerned about, because that has proven to be the case just from a historical standpoint. But we should definitely continue to reconvene and certainly revisit what's happening with markets. I mean, we've seen some upward trajectory, which is really nice. I think it's given people an opportunity to reposition. You know, when you guys had talked to me from our last conversation, one of the things I talked about was positioning. And that's what's helped me kind of survive through this is just proper positioning. When I say that, I'm talking about risk positioning, being hedged, having cash, you know, you have to be able to have optionality, and optionality is very expensive when the market is quote unquote cheap. And that's the way to be. And we'll see how the next few weeks go, but we're diving in earnings season. So we're going to get, you know, a lot of companies are suspending guidance, so we won't really get a lot of insight into that. But like I said, most of the major banks and analysts have written off retesting the 2200 low. I think 2350 is probably going to be our retest. I would be mentally prepared for that. And to your question, Steve, about where people want to be positioned, like I said, I mean, I don't think you can go wrong with tech, cloud, AI, automation, robotics, those types of industries, those types of sectors. You know, energy, I do think energy has a fighting fucking chance, even though, you know, oil's gotten shit kicked out of it. I really do think there's opportunity in energy. And keep in mind, there's a lot of high yield companies. And of course, those yields might not necessarily be safe, but I do think energy is a contrarian play right now that makes sense. So,
well, I mean, it's the market, there's risk. And so, yeah. Energy is definitely one of those. And every, you know, sector that you talked about, whether it's energy or cloud or tech or automation, there's risk in all of them, you know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, you know, it's part of the game. So, yeah. Well, Ben, I appreciate you hopping on with us tonight, kind of quick last minute, but it was fun as usual. Jim.
Yes, Steven.
Thanks, buddy.
You guys are great, man. I love you guys both, man.
You have no idea, Ben. You landed a cake of the dentist that he did not see coming.
Well, listen, man, we're all on quarantine, so we might as well set up another conversation here in the next few days.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Let's see how the next couple of days play out, and maybe hop on again this weekend just to see kind of where everything is.
All right. So, thanks for listening, Ben. You want to throw any social media or business plugs out there before we shut it down?
No, not at all. Don't follow me on Twitter. Leave me alone. if you want to follow me on Twitter, just take it for what it is. I put out information and research, and by the way, some of the shit I pay for, and I put it out on Twitter for free, so I don't want to hear your fucking opinion about it. Don't follow me on Twitter, please.
Okay, so he's not existential on Twitter.
Anyway, I have enough fucking followers.
Always been talking to you.
I have a hard enough time dealing with the followers I have. So
we're not going to ask you to close us out with a guitar riff, but good conversation, guys. And we are at Whiskey Congress on Instagram and Twitter. You can email Steve at steve@whiskeycongress.com or me, jim@whiskeycongress.com. Thank you very much, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Thanks, Jim. Appreciate it. Thanks, Steve. Appreciate you guys.